Good afternoon. I'm George Spencer. This is the afternoon show. Pauline DiCarmo, who usually does this with me, is in New York today, so I'm flying solo. We are in Scout Pines studio in Chatham. And the sound engineer who is traveling with us today for this is Heather Lloyd, who is a very talented sound engineer, among other things. Scout, I met you at a party, right?
That's correct. Yeah, I was forgetting that until you just reminded me, but that is accurate. Yeah.
Right, and we started talking about something or other, and somehow I found out that you were a painter.
Mm-hmm.
You remember this?
I do.
And I said to you, oh, do you have anything on your phone? And you said, no, my phone is in the car. So I said, okay, let's go out to the car and we'll take a look at your phone. So we got out there and you started showing me these paintings of yours. And I thought, you know, this is amazing. You know, this is very much like a guy's work that I had seen at a show at TSL.
Right.
And
I do
so I think I said to you something like, I mean, is there somebody else around who sort of paints like you? And at that point, I think you probably thought I was completely out of my mind. And so we finally found out that it was you.
Yes, I'm very glad. I'm glad we made that walk. And no, I didn't think you were out of your mind. I don't do a great job, believe it or not, of, you know, speaking on my art if I'm just out sort of in a function like that. So I'm very, very glad that you you brought it up and you remembered. And I'm very appreciative of that fact.
Yeah, no, that was fun. And then we got together again, maybe 6 months ago, because of that article in...
Yes, correct, yeah.
So that was great. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about where we are?
Okay, and I appreciate you you folks coming to me here. This is basically a two-story, two-car barn garage behind my house. I can only be out here when the weather's warm. You know, it's insulated, but somewhat haphazardly. The windows certainly are not insulated, so I kind of come out here when the weather breaks. You know, it's funny. It reminds me of farming in some way. You know, I have to wait
till the seasons.
You're exactly right. I have to wait till I know I get some good warm weather that's here for good. And I'll be out here typically from April or so until you know, I can go till about November or December.
Can you put a space heater in here?
I can. Yeah, I can. It's and again, you know what it is? It's bringing so many paints out here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it would be tough to heat it. Then you still have to heat it 24 hours a day, you know, because I can heat it when I'm working. But if I went inside and the temperature really dipped, you know, all the paints would kind of freeze.
Ah, of course.
So that's the issue. But to be honest, I like going back and forth between the two places.
What's the other place?
The other place is the basement of the house, house. And I noticed the work it's funny because I noticed a difference in the work that was created in the two spaces. When it's warm and I can be out in the barn here, I can work on a couple pieces at one time, whereas the basement, I can't use spray paint as much because of the fumes, and I tend to really kind of focus on one painting. So those ones that you see that are really, you know, really cluttered and really kind of work, those are generally kind of winter paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And the other ones are when I'm out here. But it was an old carriage house, you know, this barn that we're in now. You know, there was a hayloft upstairs and horses would have been in here, you know, 100 years ago when they built the house. And it's funny, when it really rains a lot, when it really gets damp and humid out here, you can actually still smell that kind of, you know, hay,
really?
Horse type of smell. Yeah, it's very funny after so many years. Yeah,
I was in a barn in Shokan this morning.
You've been all over the place.
Yeah, in somebody else's studio.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about growing up, which
sure
for you is a fascinating story.
Sure. I grew up in Rensselaer, New York, which is a river town, you know, 30 miles or so north of here, essentially, north and west, I guess, a little bit. And, you know, my family was not artistic really whatsoever. I didn't grow up, you know, in that type of environment. My parents were divorced when I was fairly young. I was definitely on my own a lot, or kind of looking after my younger sister. And I wasn't really inclined in the arts whatsoever. I always loved literature, even when I was young. And, you know, I devoured books. But my first exposure to art in any sort of real way that was tangible, where I kind of thought this is stuff that I could make, was actually through punk rock and graffiti when I was a younger teenager. You know, I would see these bands play, and very quickly I, you know, was asked to be in a band, and I had never played an instrument before in my life.
So this was a no audition band?
You got it. Yeah, they I met them skateboarding at the Empire State Plaza in Albany on a Saturday night, and they said, "We have a show next Friday, we don't have a drummer." And I said, "Well, how hard can that be, you know, to play punk rock music?" You know, I said, "I can figure that out in a week." So I did, and we were terrible. They were good. I was terrible. But everybody in that scene was so supportive. You know, it doesn't matter really what the music sounds like.
How did you get down there from Rensselaer? You were 16, so you could drive?
From Rensselaer to Albany? Yeah, that was all in Albany when I met
them.
That was
when you could drive at 16.
So, well, to be honest, I would take buses a lot, or skateboard. You know, I would skateboard.
That's a long trip.
Yeah. Not that far. It's right across the river. Not too bad. And I used to like traveling that way. But through punk rock in that sense, you know, you start putting out your own records. So that involves, you know, designing your own records, designing your own t-shirts and flyers, and that kind of real instant art, you know, basically made on photocopy machines or with, do you remember the transfer letters that you would buy sheets of those, and, you know, glue sticks and X-Acto knives? That kind of was my first exposure to art. Now, I didn't even really view it as fine art at that time, you know, it was just kind of, we needed a record cover, you know. That was my first exposure to art, I would say, you know, and really understanding that it's something that anybody can make, you know. You don't have to be necessarily formally trained or have a background in it, you know, beyond that, which I think is wonderful, and I in some ways wish I did have that, but that was kind of my first exposure to all that stuff.
So at the time when you were there in the New York State Plaza, was there a lot of sculpture there?
There was, you know, and it's funny because
Do you remember any of it?
I do. I remember one piece in particular, and I since have talked to Jack Shear quite a bit about it, Ellsworth, Kelly's husband, because I went to the Empire State Plaza probably about a year ago, and I noticed the one Ellsworth Kelly sculpture that's blue and yellow was pushed back onto the grass. And I don't recall it being there when I was young. And the reason why is because I remember we used to skateboard on that sculpture all the time because of the angles of the metal were such that you could do wall rides on it. So at the time, we recognized that as, you know, fine art and something that was just existed in a universe that we couldn't even understand. Jack got quite a kick out of the story.
You told him.
Yeah, I told him. And he said, oh, yeah, everyone used to skateboard on it. So they moved it back. There was another great George Rickey piece, you know, who lived out here in, I guess it's still Columbia County.
It was one of the moving.
You got it. One of the kinetic sculptures.
Yeah,
and you could stand underneath it, and this big swinging arm, it would seem like it was going to come right down on your head. Now, it was still probably, you know, 15 feet in the air. But we did, especially in the winter, we did spend a lot of time walking around that art collection. And I had friends that were, you know, would go on to school for, you know, art majors. I didn't quite appreciate what it was at the time, but I certainly have gone back and revisited it a ton. But I think even subconsciously, I do think it was pretty formative, just being around that art collection all the time. Yeah, I really do.
So you graduated from high school around here.
Yep.
And then what happened?
Oh, boy. I was definitely a lost soul at that time. So right when I graduated, my father stayed...
I mean, were you in trouble with the police or... just a teenager trying mildly, to figure out.
I mean, nothing, you know, nothing major. Yeah, but okay. I certainly was. I was kicked out of high school often. I would never consider myself, you know, a bad kid, but mm-hmm. I was very polite and respectful. Certainly,
you were probably bored to death.
Bored to death. I mean, I would hold doors open for people, and it was always yes sir, no ma'am. But yeah, I was bored to death. My parents, no one ever really spoke to me about going on to college. I don't know why, because my parents were college graduates. But I remember vividly, you know, that fall after I graduated high school in 1989, all my friends went away to college. And I was just sitting there like, what the heck do I do now? And I did really want to just get out of town. So I actually moved to Oakland, California. I had a group of friends that moved out there the year previously, guys that were a year older than me. Yeah, I just kind of hopped out of, you know, as quick as I could, and I had a place to stay there. They were incredibly kind and supportive, and that was the first place where I saw real, my roommates included, real working radical artists. You know, these were folks that were doing a lot of direct action. I think it was the first Gulf War happened, you know, right around that time. There were massive protests in San Francisco. So along with that, you know, a lot of direct action for, you know, making banners and giant puppets and posters, a lot of stenciling on the street, a lot of graffiti. And that was my first exposure to people doing that, because you didn't have anything like that, you know, at the scale happening in upstate New York at the time.
So before you went out there, were you doing stenciling and doing...
I did some graffiti, and it was...
What you call non-permission pieces?
Right, your non-permission pieces. And it was...
Where'd you get that name?
Yeah, well, it's a nice euphemism. Yeah, it sounds good when you're writing your CV, you know, to try to get into a gallery show. I was doing graffiti really badly, like really terribly, and at that time...
Let me stop you right there. Sure. Not quite sure I believe that.
No, it was atrocious.
What was atrocious
just,
out of it?
I didn't know, because I existed kind of on my own. At that time, the graffiti was really what you would just call tagging, you know, scrawling your name. But at that time...
Oh, that was like the early Basquiat.
Right, exactly. But it was not nearly as talented. But at that time, if you were in a band, you would just... Everybody would write their band name. So you would go to play a show in Syracuse or Hartford, Connecticut. And after you would play the show, you would walk around that, you know. These punk rock and hardcore shows were generally in really crappy parts of town. They weren't in proper clubs. They were in, you know, oddball, like American Legion halls, or somebody would rent out a...
Your garage.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, I know you know these spaces that I'm talking about with... ABC No Rio down there in New York City.
Did you play there?
Yeah. And so picture, you know, so you're playing these type of places. So you would go and play. Pretty remarkable space.
Did you get to see CBGB?
Yeah, we played there.
You played
also
there too.
Which was wonderful. Yep.
Did you, have you been there?
Yes.
You've been there.
I mean, it's one of my proudest kind of, you know, little feather in my cap to say that I had played there. You know?
How about the Mud Club? Did you?
Never played there.
No.
I know it, and I know there were some... You know, you had A7, which was, you know, now Niagara down there. So there were a bunch of these legendary venues. We never ventured down to the city that much. I think maybe because of being upstate kids. New York hardcore was a whole different animal, and it was fantastic, and I still love it to this day.
Were these the noise bands? That kind
not,
of thing?
Not real like, you know, hardcore music. Basically, mm-hmm. if you picture... You know, Black Flag kind of started that. It was louder and aggressive and more violent even than punk rock. And the New York bands, like New York does with everything, made it angrier and more violent than just about anywhere else. So the graffiti started by you would go out of town and you would just spray paint your band's name, you know, when you would play. And like I said, I did it really terribly, you know, awfully. So I would see graffiti in the city, and there was some in Albany, but not a lot. But I truly didn't know what I was doing. I mean, now you could literally watch, you know, YouTube tutorials and kind of how to do it. Back then, you had no idea, you know, so you would maybe get a few cans of spray paint out of, like, your uncle's garage or something, you know, and you just tried to do the best you could, you know, but I was kind of on my own in that sense, so it was bad. It was not good work, that's for sure.
I wonder if any of it's around, under posters, yeah, layers, you know, of posters.
It's funny because there's one in East Greenbush on the side of a, you know, like a shop. It was like a Big Lots, you know, store or something. And you know, you're so naive at the time when you're 15 or 16. And I was in this band and I literally spray painted it huge on the side of this building where the entire town saw it. And when people start questioning you about it, you exist in this world where you just disconnect, you know. So, like, I mean, looking back on it, and it's the same way when my children would kind of deny that they did something, you know, when you're thinking, you must be crazy. Like, I know you did this.
Did you ever get caught doing this stuff?
I did, but nothing, you know. I was always able to kind of talk my way out of it. Or, you know, be aware, you know, I know some people would do that stuff and they'd be real drunk or things like that. You know, I was always kind of hyper vigilant in that sense, you know. And yeah, I have a couple. Yeah, God, our van broke down one time outside of, I don't know where we were, like Carmel, New York or something like that. In a little plaza, you know, where there was one little grocery store, probably like an IGA or something. And there's this funky van in the parking lot because we had to wait to try to call a tow truck. Again, you know.
Is this this is after you came back from the West Coast?
This was actually, yeah, oh, you're right. So I was probably about, you know, 19 or so at the time. And
that's about the age that my oldest son got arrested for doing subway cars.
Wow.
In the Bronx.
In the city at that, I mean, everybody wrote graffiti then,
yeah,
you know, when,
yeah.
And I mean, writing on subway cars was, you know, incredible. And that was kind of the height of it, but certainly everybody even just tagged their name, you know, walking to school or something like that. That's incredible. I can't tell you how many people I run into of a certain age that are from the city and they all will say, oh yeah, I used to write, you know, and it's kind of neat.
So what'd you do out in the West Coast?
Oh man. I lived in this house, as I said.
Was this sort of a cooperative?
Basically, yeah.
House?
It was this big warehouse, and these folks were really, it was my first exposure not to just, you know, punk rock or radical art, but many of these different ancillary components, you know, and at the time, again, this is 1990, let's say, but veganism, you know, vegetarianism, this notion of these communities or neighborhoods kind of being self-sustained, you know, so there might be midwives, you know, that there might be free health clinics, or at least somebody that's an herbalist or, you know, a homeopathic practitioner. So it was really my first time being exposed to not just theoretical or reading about it, but actually seeing people live in this way. I worked in a natural food store when I was there and really met, you know, I just met so many great people. I don't think I could ever, I was always worried about, you know, even back then the Bay Area was so expensive. I just didn't see how I would be able to ever really put down roots there, you know, and just afford to live there, you know, when it's obviously 1,000 times worse now in that regard.
So then You went out there once, right? But then you came back. Did you go back again? I'm trying.
No,
you didn't.
I was just out there for 1 year and came back.
And you came back, and so then what happened?
Wow, I came back. I was really
you went to school, right?
Well, I came back. I was a really lost soul again. My friends, you know, were still in college. I was really, really a lost soul. You know, worked different jobs. I worked in a cabinet shop and ended up living there.
I mean, this was around here.
Yeah, up in Malden Bridge, actually. And a great family took me in. I didn't really have anywhere to go. They took me in, and that was another amazing education because they were the first people. I was friends with their daughters, but they were the first people to expose me to, let's say, you know, like NPR, you know, and public radio. And sort of things like that, you know, they were the somewhat eclectic amazing family, well-educated, very liberal, very progressive. And, you know, they had their big, amazing gardens, and they would, you know, can for the winter, you know. And so it was my first exposure to, how to put it, to life being a work of art, if that makes sense. Just mm-hmm. the way mm-hmm. they gardened and, you know, took care of the property, and the way they cooked, you know, with amazing jazz playing, you know, and again, the literature too, you know, just constantly. And again, this is all pre-cell phone too, you know, and pre-laptop and everything.
So people talk.
Exactly right. So they would have these amazing dinners, you know, we would kind of work hard, and they would have these amazing dinners, and they would ask, okay, what are you reading? At the time, it's, you know, you start, somebody like me, I'm starting to really get into, you know, when I was even younger, it's Kerouac and all that stuff, but starting to read different things, you know, from you know, Tom Robbins to Aldous Huxley to, mm-hmm. you know, just everything. And they had thousands of books. So it was constantly, hey, check this out. You might like this.
Do you go to the Spencertown Academy to get a supply of books every year?
I don't. It's funny. I go to the library often, and I do know their Festival of Books up there. And it's great. And we're fortunate around here to have so much of that. You know, we have a great bookstore here in Chatham. And, you know, no, books are still certainly a constant companion in my life. That's for sure.
So then you ended up, or started out, put it that way, your college career.
Yeah, yep. I applied to the Junior College of Albany. I had to actually take, you know, a few non-matriculated courses at first, so I maybe took two courses, probably, you know, like a literature course and a philosophy course. And even that was a lot, you know, I would still be there in Malden Bridge working at the cabinet shop. But to even get to Albany, I mean, it sounds like the story, you know, I walked uphill both ways, 5 miles. But I did have to walk from Malden Bridge to what we call downtown Nassau, which took about an hour. And then I'd have to take a bus from Nassau all the way into Albany, which took another hour. And then transfer from downtown Albany out to JCA. So to even just take that class, you know, it just, you know, it took me forever to get out there. And I did that. I took the two courses as a non-matriculated student, did well. Then I did matriculate. But again, you know, student loans and paying for it all. I think I went for one full year at JCA. Yeah.
And then you worked for a while.
Yeah.
And then you went back though, right?
No.
I thought we had another try on it.
No.
That was it.
Yeah, that was it.
Wow.
That was it.
Okay. So, at some point, you moved to New York, right?
No.
Oh, you never did. I thought you were doing graphics there.
No.
When did you start doing the graphics?
I mean, I never, you know, I guess after JCA, after I didn't work at the cabinet shop, I ended up working in a screen print shop
in
Troy.
That's it.
And, you know, that was up here in Troy. And I just really enjoyed doing that. You know, you could make a decent amount of money. And yeah, I think I did that probably, I'm trying to think, when my daughter Scout was born, was 96.
Oh, her name is Scout?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. So that's, you know, that was probably like, you know, the mid 90s, like 94, 95, 96, around then. Yeah.
And so you learned a lot from doing that.
I did learn a lot from doing that because it's production-based, even with my art now. And I screen printed for a long time. I screen printed probably until, you know, 2004, let's say. But because it's so production-based, it, you know, and even now looking at the pieces, I still have this notion in my head of basically, you know, an image and text, you know, mm-hmm. like that's still kind of how my brain is oriented. You know, if I look at even a blank canvas, or certainly the old signs that have that lettering and typography already on it, that's kind of just what my brain sees because I did that for so long. So I just think, okay, text, you know, that information, typography, pair it with an image, and that's still basically how I paint. Yeah.
So when did you actually start spending a significant amount of time painting?
Doing art as an artist. I did not start that until 2001. And I started that, I was working at a screen print shop that was right here in the village of Chatham, actually. And a gentleman by the name of Chris Stain moved from Baltimore to work at that screen print shop. And I remember the owner of the screen print shop saying to me, "You're gonna love this guy, like you like the same music. He was a graffiti artist in Baltimore. He does this different type of art now. You guys are gonna get along wonderfully." And that was 2001, and we did get along wonderfully, you know. And Chris started showing me, he was doing stencil art at that time. And he was in some pretty big shows, you know, at the Corcoran in D.C. You know, he had done some amazing work. And he still is an unbelievable graffiti artist. But he was doing the stencil and he said to me, "I know you'll be able to get this down." He goes, "Because screen printing is the same way, where you look at an image and your eyes already start to break it down, meaning you know what's called like the undercoat, you know, which is going to be the first color you put down. Mm-hmm. You know that your darker color has to, what they call, trap everything." Mm-hmm. So you can see an image and you know how to break it down. Okay, that's four colors. You know how to separate it, you know, by just looking at it. And stencils were the same way. And he said, "Oh, you're going to be a natural at this." And so we started making paintings together. He showed me the materials. I lived in Chatham at that time. I moved to Chatham in 2001 from Albany. And he had said, you know, "Let's just start." We just started making these paintings, you know. He had been making them on found metal and these objects. And I think because of my background in the cabinet shop and sort of being comfortable with these building materials, I said, "Why don't we get some old plywood and start making these paintings on plywood, and we'll start putting them up in boarded up buildings in Albany." That's right. I was a little clarification. I actually still did live in Albany when I first met him at the beginning of 2001. Chris reminded me of that a little while ago. I moved to Chatham probably within a few months of meeting him. But when I first met him, I worked in Chatham, but still lived in Albany. And we started putting up paintings.
How big were the paintings?
The paintings were probably, we would actually measure. So for example, I lived right off of Grand Street, you know, right in front of the governor's mansion, basically, in Albany. We would measure up the boarded up windows and doorways of buildings.
These were site-specific.
Site-specific, non-permission work. You got it.
Non-permission.
You got it. So I would measure, you know, and it would be a boarded up doorway. And I'd say, okay, this one's, you know, 3 feet by 6 feet. And I was still friends with a bunch of builders and guys in the cabinet shop. So they would always be very helpful with giving us plywood and cutting it down if we needed it. And we would go out at night and install it in these boarded up buildings. You know,
now, what happened to these pieces?
A bunch of, you know, it's funny. One is still on the side of a church, which is on Madison Avenue in Albany. They've been trying to turn it into an art center. And that's been there since, you know, again, 2002, something like that. A lot of them stayed around forever. A few ended up in a place called the Free School. That's a little alternative education school right there in that neighborhood. So they brought one inside when the building looked like it was going to get, you know, purchased and renovated. A lot of them, people started, and then what happened is when people kind of knew what was going on, you know, I've seen them ended up on, you know, I see them in websites, or people will send me a thing like it's in somebody's house somewhere, you know.
Did anybody ever come to you and say, "Listen, I have a piece of yours, I want to pay you for it"?
Not to pay me for it. Not to pay me for it, Bart. But they have told us they've had it. They're almost kind of, you know, almost wanted some type of, you know, it was a confession of sorts. we know that's, you know, once it leaves your hands, you have no control over it. You know, it's if I were walking around and saw something like that, I didn't know you know, about it, I'd be inclined to do it myself. But we put quite a bit up in Albany, and we still do. You know, Chris will come up a few times a year, and we will put some up. And again, now with, you know, Instagram and social media, the word gets out immediately.
You're not Banksy, are you?
We put no.
You sure?
No, a positive.
Okay.
A positive. But in his, I certainly love and admire his work. But we, you know, we put some up last winter, but and it lasted in downtown. It lasted maybe 6 months or so.
You know, there's a nice house in Kinderhook that has a wall on it outside that could use something like that.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah, is it your house or no?
I can't tell. I'm not sure. I'm not, maybe the bank
owns it.
Well,
that's good.
I think, I think the bank took it back this
morning.
It's
yours temporarily, right. Well, hang on as long as you can.
So I'm going to send you the measurements.
Okay, perfect. That would be great. I'd love to. Yeah, I would love to do that.
So the railroads.
The railroads. Yeah, that's, you know, that's another... growing up in Rensselaer, right, you have Amtrak right there. So the trains and the lore of the trains was really kind of embedded in me, you know.
Were there uncles, people when you were growing up who, exactly,
a
who
ton
worked.
Of uncles and cousins that worked there, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And even my...
In the rail yard.
Exactly right, yep.
Basically, so they were welders or...
You got it, electricians, mm-hmm. welders, just on the track gang. My uncles even will tell stories... I mean, it sounds like you're talking about, you know, the Artful Dodger or something like that. But it's, you know, they tell stories of going down with buckets and actually picking up coal that, you know, fell off the coal trains to, you know, put in their, you know, furnaces at the time. You know, their parents would say, hey, go down and get us a few pieces of coal, you know. So that type of lore and, you know, you hear them constantly, right? And you know, walking over the train bridge from Rensselaer to Albany, it really was kind of embedded in my DNA. And then you have the subway movement, as you talked about, that your son was involved in New York City. So graffiti on the subway in New York City was kind of the pinnacle of illegal graffiti in this movement, you know, that sprang forth very organically. And, you know, it became this, you know, worldwide phenomenon. Well, when I moved to Chatham, of course, a railroad town, then the trains go right through here, a lot of graffiti artists, when New York City basically started, you know, a train with graffiti on it, I forget what year it was, but it couldn't even leave the yard, right? They would bring it in to buff it, you know, so people stopped spray painting, you know, on subway cars. And, you know, a lot more walls and bridges and everything like that. But shortly thereafter, people realized, God, these freight trains go all over the country, all over North America. You know, so it's not like seeing your name on an elevated platform in New York City and saying, wow, I did that up in the Bronx and it's going to go through the five boroughs. Now it's kind of thinking, wow, I can do this in a freight yard somewhere and this train's going to go all over the country.
Now, were you doing that?
I was not doing that at the time, you know, when I was younger, but mm-hmm. I started to get involved in that at around, again, you know, 2001.
And was that the point in which, my recollection is you knew some people who actually traveled on these trains.
I still do. Chris Stain, being from Baltimore, you know, was aware of it also. Baltimore, you know, has a huge, you know, huge train yards, a lot of industry. So he certainly knew people that were doing it. So it was right around that time, 2001, where freight train graffiti really started to take off. And, you know, what people call street art really started mm-hmm. to take off also, you know. So it was kind of wide open, and anything you saw, you thought, you know, hey, we can do this here. Let's do this. So that's kind of, and, you know, there's lots of trains around here, you know, so you have accessibility to that. Yep. And in the course of that, doing that, yeah, we know a lot of people that
you had to learn how to work fast.
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
You had to figure it out in advance.
You had to figure out in advance. Exactly right. A lot of planning, you have to be hyper vigilant and alert. I certainly wouldn't advocate anybody doing it. You know, the trains are just these...
I'm not going to ask you what you did.
They're these beasts. You know, they're just... I mean, I know people that have, you know, been disfigured. I know people that have had, you know, their legs run over by trains. It's very, very dangerous. But yeah, there is a subculture of folks that do it, you know, and that's partly why I wanted to have that component in my show in Chatham, because I just think it's interesting. The train literally cuts right through the center of town, and people see all these things, right? You see huge graffiti pieces, and you see the monikers and markings, you know, and smaller, usually on the sides and end of the car. But I kind of wanted to make that connection for people that walk into a gallery on Main Street Chatham and think, these are some of the very same people that you see on these freight trains, you know, that go through town.
So tell us about the show that you're...
Yeah, the show is at Thompson Giroux Gallery on Main Street in Chatham from August 10th until September 22nd.
So that's a good run.
Yeah, it's a nice run. It's basically, it's similar kind of concept to a show I did at TSL a few years ago that we were talking about actually earlier, where when you and I met at that party. It's primarily...
That was a great show.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate that show. I really appreciate that. It's primarily a solo show, but I did want to have a component of these freight train moniker artists, especially being right in Chatham, right on the train line. So, you know, I have quite an assortment of railroad spike bucket lids and also bottles that these moniker artists from all over North America have contributed. And it's a really...
Contributed for the show.
Contributed for the show. Ah. Yeah. And these are folks that aren't... They're not easy to get a hold of, you know. They're very shy about... Most of them, you know, do not show at galleries. Most of them don't really view themselves as artists, per se. Although some of them are unbelievably talented.
Well, you had some at the...
Yes, yep. I had a few of them there.
That big show at...
Yes.
Well, at TSL, but yes. You had some of them at the year-end show at Thompson Giroux.
I had a spike bucket lid there, yep. And I did, yeah, and I did a few bottles there. Yeah. You're right, yes. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Yeah. So it's... I think it will be a nice mix of stuff. It's the first time I've painted on canvas.
Is it going to be mainly canvas?
My pieces, I have 8 big canvas pieces.
And by big, you mean what?
I have 3 that are 5x5, and I have 6 that are 3x4.
Well, this is one we're looking at right here, right?
Yes, you got it.
So maybe you want to tell us just a little bit about that piece, because that sort of gets into a lot of other things you're interested
in. That piece is... It's a portrait of a gentleman from a Black Lives Matter protest in Albany, New York. This is one of the amazing things about stuff like Instagram, where you can meet an artist or photographer via that platform. And it was this amazing woman, Shannon, who lives in Albany and took these beautiful portraits. And I just wrote her and said, can I use these for paintings? And she said, sure, you know, go ahead. So there's a series of portraits, a series of paintings based on her portraits taken from that Black Lives Matter protest in Albany. And this particular one that we're looking at in the barn has a gentleman kind of looking head on, you know, dead in the camera. But I've superimposed over that a piece of 1950s clip art of a young boy saying the Pledge of Allegiance with his hand over his heart. And in doing so, it looks like he's basically trying to quiet the protester, you know. That was sort of my idea with that one. So I've been taking lately, I used to just do the portraits. Now I have been mixing it with some of that clip art, you know, that was usually designed in the 50s, you know, and it was kind of conveying this real Americana, you know, apple pie type of notions of, you know, patriotism and what family life meant. And I think it's interesting to juxtapose that with these newer portraits of...
Do you have some smaller pieces there too?
Oh, I have a bunch of bottles, but you know, I don't have much small. No, I really don't. Mm-hmm. I have a bunch of bottles there, in some prints, and I screen printed on, you know, some empty cigarette packs and things like that. But I really wanted to focus on some larger paintings. So no, I don't really have smaller paintings there. No.
So the other thing that's going to be there is these covers to the spike containers or yes. railroad ties or whatever they're
yep,
called.
You got it.
Are those something that gets exhibited often?
Not often, no. You know, one of the gentlemen who goes by the moniker of Colossus of Rhodes, he was a retired railroad guy.
And into puns.
Yeah, exactly right. You got it. And in a very, you know, he was involved with sort of, you know, mail art stuff going, you know, way back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. He recently has had quite a bit of attention for his work. You know, he's been at, you know, SF MoMA, and he's been in some bigger shows, but that's somewhat rare. You know, most of these folks really like to stay under the radar, you know, so they don't exhibit it often. A good friend of mine, Kurt, did put together an amazing museum show of what we would call moniker art in a museum in Ohio last year. And that, I think, was really the first kind of proper survey of all this stuff, going back to, you know, railroad workers first kind of starting to do that, you know, 100 years ago. Yeah, it was amazing.
So one of the things that I remember you're saying, right, I think you said this, was that the things that you were doing on buildings and whatnot were all things that anybody could do. And I think that is such an interesting concept because, first of all, it tells everybody they can do it, but it also, in sort of indirectly, says, why do we need to spend all these enormous amounts of money and redo MoMA at $1 billion every 5 years?
Yeah.
So what's going on in the art world that doesn't make sense?
Well, you know, and it's funny because I'm probably... I don't know a ton about it, to be honest with you. Although I'm becoming, you know, I'm deliberately kind of becoming more. Perhaps it was a bit of a crutch to say I don't know what any of this is, and you know, I feel like I've had to know a little bit more about it. I do think you have this amazing kind of juxtaposition, right? I think it would be easier now than ever for anybody to make art, you know, whatever they wanted to make, right?
Yeah.
You could do it. You could watch tutorials if you wanted. You could, whatever you wanted to do. And I think people kind of understand it doesn't have to be something that I have to go to school for, unless I have some, you know, crazy innate talent and I can draw beautifully, then I can transfer that to these other mediums. So I think people understand that, but there still is a disconnect. You know, I think some of the institutions that you talked about, you know, when I was in Los Angeles last year, and I'll go to all these, you know, I'll go to the Broad and I'll go to LACMA and I'll go to all these places. And I love, you know, a lot about it, but it is such, I mean, it's too easy to say sort of corporate, you know, there's just,
no,
such,
it's not, no, it's such, too easy, but it's right.
Right. And there's such massive amounts of money in this need to create these shows that are going to generate, you know, tons of interest and revenue. Obviously the things that you know, that are happening at the board of the Whitney, you know, and certain, people involved in that board.
Maybe you should encapsulate that.
Yeah. Some of the nefarious, you know, certain people on these boards, you know, they have some pretty nefarious ties, you know, to corporations
that
do very, very harmful things to the planet and humanity, you know, and, you know, artists now have been getting a little bit more keen to that, to say, you had artists pulling out of the Whitney Biennial, you know.
Did you go to that? Did you see it?
I did not.
You haven't seen it?
No, I did not. So I just think I do think, you know, when I talk to some artist friends of mine who, again, I didn't know people like this when I was younger, but people will talk about, you basically have these massive art stars now, and then you have this lower tier of everyone just trying to survive. Whereas, you know, when I talk to people that were really working, let's say even 10, 15, 20 years ago, they could actually make a good living, you know, as artists, and they could sell paintings for, you know, $5,000-$10,000. And that does seem harder to, from what, you know, just I'm gathering secondhand, you know, that it really kind of split, you know, and there's sort of a real lower tier, and then there's this kind of absurd, you know, but it's, I think it's also sort of the way of the world, right? It's either, you know, you're wearing...
Well, it's the same equality that we have in...
Exactly.
In the economy.
That's exactly right. You're either in, you know Louis Vuitton or you're shopping at Walmart.
You know, I mean, the funny thing is that I think that, or I know that a lot of people who are enormously successful in the business world just happen to be in the right place at the right time.
Without a doubt, sure. Know?
And that happens in a lot of professions.
Absolutely.
No doubt, including including the profession we're talking about.
Without question, yes. Yeah. It's and I do think it's, as you said, I don't think it's too dissimilar between, you know, the 1% and the sort of concentration of wealth in this country. I think it's related, you know. I think it's related. And art for a lot of people like that is this sort of commodity that's kind of bought and sold like a
comes and goes.
A stock. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, comes and goes. So the kind of music you like, when I saw you last, you told me about the Felice Brothers.
Yeah. Some
and
local
Mother
local
Maybelle Carter.
Yeah, Mother, yeah. Some old kind of old country stuff.
What,
you know?
What appealed to you about those?
Just these stories, you know, very kind of salt of the earth, you know, type stories, you know.
About, are they different from what you do?
About working folks. No. I'll be honest. I've made a conscious effort lately because I find the, you know, the political climate in this country so
poisonous.
Depressing, you know, and the news cycle, you know, because I've always been kind of a news and political junkie. I've actually had to limit my exposure to that. And I've consciously decided, I still will, I listen to my Democracy Now! And I try to read the Times and I dive in shorter and try to get it all. I've been really trying to listen to happier music, you know, because it's just, you know, lately I've been listening to a lot of New Orleans jazz that's a little more, you know, just, it puts me in a good mood.
Puts you in a, so you can go on to the next.
Yeah, exactly right. So I don't jump off a bridge.
Atrocity.
Yeah, you got it.
Well, we're almost at the end. Like, we have about 45 seconds to go.
All right.
So is anything you want to add? What I will add is everybody's got to come and see your show.
Well,
because, you know, the previous one you had at TSL was fantastic. And I know that this is going to be.
Thank
any,
you.
Any thing you want to tell us about what's going to happen in the future or plans you got? Or?
I will just keep, you know, keep working hard. But I really do. I want to thank you both for coming here today, because these types of forums, this type of stuff is really, really needed, and I think it fortifies a lot of people. So I'm very grateful that you guys came out to chat and talk to me.
I know you're busy because you got a big show, and that's complicated, and you got to do a lot of things at once to make it happen. So thanks for taking the time out to be with us.
Oh, thank you. I really appreciate it.
And thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
Without the sound, we would be nowhere.
Thank you, Heather.
My pleasure.